Hello, everyone. You're listening to In the Weeds, an agriculture podcast hosted by Monica Jean and the Michigan Field Crops team.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another In the Weeds with Monica Jean here. I'm on the field crops team for MSU Extension, and I love my job. I love getting to learn new stories about what farmers are doing, and so that's what we're doing today. We have Carl Wagner here, the third. That makes me sound pretty cool, actually.
It's pretty illustrious, yeah.
Yeah, I should have started adding Monica Jean the third. I was just going to name some cattle after myself, really. But.
The first and only.
Yeah, that's true. I can just put number one on there. So we have Carl on here. He is a farmer in Southwest Michigan, and we're going to learn a little bit what he's doing on his farm. But we also have Brooke Wilkie back with us. So he's been on a couple times. Apparently, he just really likes hanging out. So thanks again, Brooke. For coming back on. And so we'll go around and introduce ourselves. Brooke, do you mind?
Great to be back. I'm super excited. We've got Carl too. Carl's a good friend and great farmer, and so excited to hear what he has to share. I am at the Kellogg Biological Station working in field crop systems innovation and specifically long-term research, including long-term agroecosystem research, LTAR project. So we're always trying to figure out how to work with farmers to improve our agroecosystems for the better of everything. So excited to be here. Thanks, Monica.
Yeah. And I do want to mention, we did just do an update about what KBS is doing these days with Taylor and Christine. So if you're like, what is Brooke talking about? Please go listen to the other podcasts, because I think they did a really nice job at a 2022 summary of the cool things you got going on. So, and then Carl, who are you? Why are you here?
It's a good question. Why am I here? I'm just happy to be here, and thank you for the invitation to speak. And I farm. I'm Niles, Michigan, and grew up on a farm there, row crop dairy farm with my parents and two siblings, younger brother and younger sister, and still work with them. We do corn, soybeans, small grains, hay, even some grapes for Welch's grape juice. And then still have the dairy. My brother's still a dairyman there. And then I also, besides farming with my parents and brother, I also do some of my own things. I own a small seed business and seed processing company. And then I also work as a certified crop advisor in an ag retail position at a co-op.
So you sleep a lot is what I'm hearing. You're just chilling.
The bags underneath my eyes. Podcast can't see it, but that's all right.
We're twinning with that. And actually, I think Brooke, you got them too. We're all working hard these days. So, all right. Well, we can jump into it here. Can we learn a little bit more about what you got going on the farm? Like, what's your rotation, and maybe how has that changed? Because you do sound very diverse.
Yeah, I think the trend has been gaining diversity over the last few years. I think it's still a work in progress, quite frankly, but we're getting there. You know, coming from what is a majority corn and soybean rotation, we are injecting more diversity through increasing small grain acres. So for me, that's the wheat, the barley, the rye, doing different things like sorghum, milo, grain sorghum. And diversifying out with that, still doing hay in the rotation in some regards, but and then using cover crops, probably not as much as I like to, but trying and experimenting. And Brooke is probably my number one go-to guy when I got questions about what to do or what not to do on that, for sure. So that kind of sums up the crop rotation right now, is just coming from really almost totally majority corn soybean rotation to starting to move that needle and trying to interject some different diverse crops in there. So, yeah.
How many years have you guys been working on that? Like, has it been 5 years of change, 10 years of change?
It's between that 5 and 10. I mean, it's been incremental. You know, I think my own passion and interest in doing small grain productions grown that over the last 5 to 7 years. And then, you know, in the same time span, that's opened opportunities for more cover crop options. So playing around with those things. And then always just keeping your ears open for different opportunities. The grain sorghum's happened for the last 3 years, I think. And that's just had a play where, you know, I guess when we're evaluating what we're doing and why we're doing it, you know, ultimately we're trying to make a profitable cash flow, of course. But beyond that is, you know, I think adding diversity is giving us agronomic benefits as well as economic benefits. It's spreading out risk. The grain sorghum was a thing where we said, you know, is that got to fit on some of our marginal, and I say really marginal because maybe we farm a lot of marginal ground, but on the most marginal sandy loam acres, hey, let's put this here. We've got a market next to us. And we can get into the details of why we did that. But you know, things like that, we're always evaluating, or at least I'm trying to always evaluate what's the next opportunity and what's out there. So, yeah.
Is the market, because you do have cattle, like, has that really helped? Because if you mess it up, you can feed it, or no, not necessarily.
There is a big plus to having cattle, because in anything that I've done, whether it's malting barley doesn't make grade years ago or anything like that, having livestock's a really nice, I don't know what you want to call it. It's a nice plan B. it's a safety net for sure, because you have another way to use that resource for that. That's right. So.
My old crap option.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I love that. That's such a great resource. I agree. And I also love how you're talking about putting some of your marginal acres to different crops instead of just trying to figure out how to grow the mainstream crops. So can you tell us a little bit more about that? You know, how sorghum or other crops might fit on more marginal lands, or I assume some of it's related to drought and mitigating the risk of drought. So what fits where on your farm?
Well, that's right. And, you know, I think part of this is always, once again, just evaluating year to year productivity on different crops and knowing our cost of production, knowing what the profitability is, and then, you know, not being afraid to take a hard look at any crop, any field, any particular unit of the business and saying, what do we need to do to make this better? I think, you know, for instance, the grain sorghum, it's going on acres that putting corn on those acres is just too big of a risk. I think you put so much money into that corn crop. And if your realistic yield is, I'd be embarrassed to tell you, but I don't think it's a surprise to some folks that farm this type of ground is, you know, man, if I got 125 bushel average, that'd be great on that corn. Well, that's not a good reason to go out plant corn, to be honest. And so then you start saying, well, what else can we put out there that is drought tolerant, that can deal with those drier years and mitigate some of that financial risk that we have putting all that money into that corn crop? And so this Milo, there's a local market, local-ish. It's not local enough. My dad does most of the hauling, and he reminds me that it's not local enough, but it's somewhat close enough to make it worthwhile to grow this. And then so happens that the market's close to some lime quarries, and so then we can backhaul lime and, you know, save some money on that and lower our lime cost. And so looking for synergies there and looking to cut cost of production as, where we can, and plan for profit. So that's what kind of drives me doing those things.
What is that market like?
I believe this actually goes all for bird seed.
What about the grapes? Do they fit on the same type of marginal land, and how long do you keep them there and so forth?
They do. And, you know, this gives credit to my parents because they, you know, for being dairy farmers, you know, this is back in, forget the year, 98, perhaps, they put the vineyard in. And that was their thing was, you know, here's a piece of ground that's really sandy. It's difficult to get a good crop off of. And then there were some opportunities with National Grape to put a vineyard in and get a grower's contract. So that's what drove them for the same reasons was, can we do something different and better with this ground and diversify? And so then they put the vineyard in there, and that's exactly what it does. And so, you know, you've got a perennial crop out there, and it's definitely managed a lot differently than anything else that we have on the farm. So yeah, but that's what drove them to that decision as well.
So they've been out there for 25 years or so.
Yeah.
So when you talk about marginal land, I just want to make sure it's sand. You have a lot of
sand,
right?
It's, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, there's different kinds of marginal ground, but for us, that when I refer to that, it is the really sandy loam. It might be generous to call it sandy loam. It might be some type of sand, but we'll call
it's
it
aspirational. Well, you're like me.
It's aspiring to be a sandy loam. Yeah, real coarse soil types that really low organic matter, and it doesn't take very long spell of dry weather at the wrong time in the summer to really just take a ton of yield out of any crop. And that's also where, you know, that's influenced us to do more no-till. I think, you know, from an agronomic standpoint, I'm just trying to figure out how do we build up soil organic matter, with the focus being, can I hold more water in this ground? Can I hold more nutrients? But the water holding capacity is probably the biggest thing there. So
did you use technology at all to kind of determine that? Like, are you using something like, so you can track that your yields haven't been going greater? You know, is there a tool that you've used over the years to help kind of decide what is more marginal, so it needs to get put into something else? Or is it just like you lived it, so you don't need a thing like a technology to help you make those decisions?
All the above. I mean, it's all about making observations every day and in different ways. So, monitoring soil fertility and doing soil tests, looking at organic matter content that way, and evaluating what soil you have. And of course, observationally knowing what soil you have whether you're in a tractor or on the combine at the year end of the year, and you know that ground, right? After years of doing that. And then yield monitor. We were probably pretty late to the game, but it's been a few years now. It's been over five. I think we've had a yield monitor in the combine that we've been taking that data and, you know, layering that together with other things and making those observations to say, oh, well, that's a wake up call, because all those other things are good, but when you're able to map that out to the bushel across acres over multi years, it really does clarify some things. Even if you hadn't knew it, it quantifies it, and then you really are able to, I think, with more confidence, go forward and make decisions.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you've been very thoughtful about evaluating the status of your fields, right? And saying, up, that one is marginal, let's mix it up within the field or the whole field. Let's do something different. Can you kind of go in a little bit to like what cover crops you are using, or maybe how you decide where to put them and what you're doing, and just a little bit more about the cover crops?
I've tried a few different things, nothing too unique, I guess. Most of the cover crop ends up being cereal rye or wheat. Done some red clover, done some tillage radish. It never as much as I'd like to, and that's usually because I don't think we're making the time or have the time to do what we want on that side of the farm. That's one thing that I'm sure we're not the only ones that struggle with, it is making time to do these things. And that's one thing that will get put off to the side. And I think to have real success with it, you got to plan for it and make time for it. But that's one of those things that we're still working toward, is how to build that into the system.
Okay. And you like using those single species or just a more...
Usually single species. I mean, the radishes will go in with cereal rye, for instance, but otherwise it's single species. Clover's been frost seeded into the small grains. Otherwise, things are put in as time allows and logistics allow after corn and soybeans come off. So, yeah.
That's great.
One thing I think we know about cover crops is that they're beneficial. It's hard to argue against the benefits of them, but they're also difficult in several ways. You mentioned the time component of just getting it done. Are there other challenges that you've faced with cover crops coupled with, you know, strategies to overcome those challenges?
You know, I think just timing is the biggest problem, is just logistics and timing. You know, there's obviously a cost component of that. You have to evaluate that cost and say, what's the return on this? I mean, I'm a believer in the value of cover crops and what it can do for us. I also understand, and I talk with a lot of other farmers, you know, that have kind of tiptoed into cover crops and maybe backed out of it. That can be caused by just saying, well, I don't really see the benefit of it, or I don't see much growth out of this cover crop. And, well, part of that is because it's an afterthought and it's not being worked around into the system, and you're going to get what you put into it. And so late establishment of a cover crop or is resulting in poor stands or lack of growth. And so guys are kind of not seeing the benefit of it. And I mean, that's our challenge, is just doing that, getting it timely, putting it in such a way that it has success and does what it needs to do.
Yeah. It takes time too, to see those changes like play out in to feel beneficial. And that's hard too. I'm pretty impatient. And so someone's like, you got to do this really hard thing that's like a weird time. And then you got to like figure it out in the spring too, when it's like panic time trying to get stuff in. Oh, and like, on top of that, it's probably going to take several years of doing this for you to actually see it. Like, that doesn't sound fun, but it sounds like, actually, I just saw research at a Blush's lab at U of M that if you're doing it over 5 years, the difference that it makes in order to get things planted in the spring by rainfall. And so that soil just becoming so much more dynamic as far as its water holding capacity. And I'm still looking into the details of how they captured all of their information, but it just was really promising on like, it can be hard, but if you stick to it and like, you kind of get it figured out, eventually it does make an impact, a pretty large impact on the farm. So
I think I just listened to that information there at a field day. That was last week, actually.
Yes, you did. We were talking about that field day, actually, when we...
I sure did. I went there mostly because it was U of M, and I had to wonder, what are they doing in this this area of expertise? But
it's really what we need. We need a lot of evidence to support that claim that we make, that cover crops are good if you stick with it. But we just need to figure out how to avoid... like the disasters or the apparent failures, you know, like the, oh, I didn't get much growth, or, oh, I forgot to terminate it and the cover crop used all the water, or, you know,
the spring, that was definitely a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. But those are all things that can be, you know, managed and mitigated. It's just more timeliness, like you said, you know.
Yeah. And learning, unfortunately, you're like, oh, I definitely should have terminated that a couple weeks earlier, or all right. Well, we're going to work into tillage. So you mentioned you do some no-till on the farm, or reduced tillage, or you're doing something. What are you doing?
We are doing something. Sometimes we don't know what we're doing, but day to day. But I think majority of our acres are no-till. And when I say no-till, there's no tillage going on year to year. There's still some acres, especially around the dairy, for a variety of reasons, that we still do some tillage there in the near the dairy operation. But we kind of went to no-till over the years. My dad started that, it's been over 10 years ago. And the funny thing was, at the start of it was simply because some of the ground that we do farm is, we got more than just sand. We have gravel too. And so you've got a lot of rocks, a lot of glacial till out there. And so sometimes, the impetus for doing this for my dad at one time was, he was just tired of bringing rocks up and having to deal with rocks all the time, because there's just no end to them. So he just thought he'd let it rest and let it lie. And so that, I think, is the longest field that's been no-till. And then, of course, we've moved on from there, and for reasons of, you know, saving time and manpower and woman power on getting across these acres in the spring. And then, of course, all the other benefits, building organic matter, soil structure, soil health, we hope. And that's a long-term project. I think it takes time to see the benefits. And every once in a while, you still question it, though, too. Like a year like this, where it was extremely dry in the spring, the no-till didn't look so good, at least around here, for a period of time compared to the tilled ground, you know, when you looked at crop growth. Now, I believe that in the end, we'll see the yields come back, and you're going to see that no-till do just as good, or maybe even outdo the tilled ground, just because I think at the end of the day, if there's some kind of compaction issue being exacerbated by the dry weather, It's going to make up for it on that, especially on that long-term no-till ground where there was more water holding capacity, I think, at the end of the day. And I think that stuff caught up faster and even outdid the conventional tillage in our neighborhood anyway at the end of the season on corn and beans. But so it's a long-term project, but I think that's one that we've been committed to and will continue to be committed to. I think the only thing that's opened up different thoughts is I have played around with vertical tillage a little bit. We've got a neighbor with a unit that he bought a few years ago, and I've really only ever used it here after soybeans, just to work ground to help me get my wheat crop and barley and rye crops seeded a little bit more timely, get better seed soil contact. And I have some interest in what that tool is doing as a tool. I don't know that I want to use it on every acre, but it's might have a place. So,
have you adjusted your nutrient management at all?
Yeah, I mean, we do grid sampling, soil sampling, and variable rate lime. We don't necessarily variable rate our other nutrients just because usually we're doing a blend in the spring. You know, because of the no-till, we're sampling at different, you know, at a shallower depth. We're trying to keep an eye on, I think pH is probably the biggest concern with that program. And you know, the other lesson, of course, if you're going to do no-till, is you really don't want to be doing no-till on ground that's deficient in any big way in phosphorus or potassium or anything else. So trying to get and keep those fields' fertility up to where they need to be is critical, and keeping on top of it. And you know, one thing about coarser soil types, and we do, and don't want to get the wrong impression, we farm, you know, poorly drained soils and some clays. But the majority of it is, you know, coarser soil types. You've got to spoon feed those things, and you just can't let off keeping an eye on those year to year, every 2 years. I mean, you just got to keep on it constantly, because it'll get off kilter real quick, right? If you don't keep on it. So
yeah.
Carl, do you have any wet areas that you farm?
We do. There's, like I said, there's some poorly drained farms that my dad farms that they've got some old tile that needs some work needs some help, because there's definitely some poorly drained areas that make it a challenge to get out there. And it's a minority of our acres, but they are out there. Yeah.
Are some of those part of the conversion to no-till, and have you witnessed any improvements in your drainage just from switching to no-till in some of those areas?
It's yes and no. There's no doubt that soil structure and building soil structure and having some no-till or reduced tillage paradigms in those situations help. I really do think they help. The issue for us is, once again, it's a management issue. Is sometimes in those fields, to get the crop out, you end up doing things that you shouldn't do, or going in when you shouldn't, or want to, and quite frankly, just running up the fields, you know, because they are that kind of drainage. And once you do that, you've got to go back in and fix what you've made of a mess. So that's the issue for us on those fields. How do we change that? I don't know. I there's just going to be years like that. So it's hard to have a really long-term no-till project on those fields for us. Probably the answer is, one, is investing in a better drainage tile. But these are rented fields, which makes that a challenge to put that kind of investment in some of these fields. But drainage tile, better drainage systems would help. That'd probably be first step. And then from there, that would help open up the opportunities to do more no-till and some other things. So.
All right, so we've been kind of going around and talking about moisture management a lot. I'd like to dive in a little bit into, like, you do have some irrigation. I mean, who doesn't down there, right? But what does that investment look like, and how has it evolved? With the difficulty that comes with predicting the weather, I'm just wondering, like, how you view irrigation. Is that, like, just a must at this point, and you're going to continue to work on getting it, or like, how have you been managing that?
Well, I think the management on irrigation for us is it a must? I don't know if it is or isn't it, but it seems to be a critical key of reducing risk on these certain acres and increasing productivity. We have center pivots and we have hard hose units. So we keep busy with that. I think our long-term plan is to keep putting more irrigation out, just because just the risk outlay, just so much money you put into these crops anymore. It's just, you can have a really great year or two. You can have some average years. It really only takes one bad year to just take it and snuff it all out. And it's just hard to recover from that. And that's where I think irrigation has a place for us, is we just got to eliminate and take away that bottom end yield, that bottom end year where you're just set, you know, have a real dry summer at the wrong time. And so it's risk management on that side. I talked to another fellow and he had a good angle on it, which was, he said, I have irrigation, not so much just about yield on my crop, but I'm trying to build my soil with that. Meaning you have a coarse soil type, it's low organic matter, and that kind of begets itself, because, you know, it never produces, it's hard to produce a good crop. It's hard to produce a crop with lots of crop residue. And so it just begets itself, and it's hard to get out of that cycle. And so, well, how do you do that? Because at the end of the day, the limiting factor is moisture. So, you know, he kind of gave me an angle of saying, I'm actually linking that to building my soil organic matter. I am building crop residue. I'm increasing crop productivity on that acre for that reason. And I thought that was an interesting angle. But we're on a mission to increase that. I think the challenge is evaluating our profitability and our ability to go out and buy units. We're kind of following the tracks of other folks, but there's other folks that have been buying used units. There's opportunities to buy used pivots from across the country, some farther places than near. But, you know, if you know the right people and are able to do it yourself, you can really reduce your cost on that system. And that seems to be a big help for us. And I think that's probably our way we're going to do this, is probably not necessarily putting new systems up, but starting with used systems and then going from there. So, yeah.
Carl, as you vision irrigation for your farm, how much thought do you have to give to sort of the field and landscape configuration? Because a lot of our fields in Michigan were divided in fairly small areas, and now we have tree lines and other, you know, things that make large, efficient irrigation systems difficult. So how much of a challenge do you have there, and what do you do to kind of make the most of it?
Yeah, there is a challenge there. You know, we're still have a lot of different wooded areas and tree lines, and our topography is pretty hilly. We're pretty steep in places, not everywhere, but on parts of what we farm it is. And so that really dictates what you can or want to do. You know, when it comes to tree lines, we've cleared out some tree lines here in the last couple of years. I think with a balanced approach, you know, I think there's moderation and is good in everything. I would say that it's obvious why tree lines have been removed and we've increased field sizes, because you have a yield monitor, you learn real quick the penalties of having a small segmented field with a lot of wooded areas and border areas. It just really dawns on you. That's why a nice big square field is just worth having. But there's moderation in that. I think we do take a very balanced approach to evaluating what do we want to take out and where. I think there's value still to tree lines. I think there's probably, I don't know, maybe there won't be, but I feel like there'll be a day when we'll be putting some tree lines back in. But, you know, not all of them, but there'll probably be in our area some places where maybe it went too far the other way. Because I'll be honest, on the other side of it too, is big is better to a point, but then I've seen some systems that are so big that, Mr. Kelly could speak to it, but you know, you get a pivot so big, you really can't even get the pivot to cross that ground fast enough and put enough water on in a very dry weather system. And so there's actually limits to how big you'd want a field, I think, on that side from a irrigation point of view. But that's one of our things that we're working on, is clearing some trees out and setting ourselves for putting those pivots in. I mean, that's what we did actually this last fall. We actually bought our own excavator for the first time and learned we didn't know anything about excavators, but we're figuring it out. And so we worked on some trees there, and I think that's part of the system there is you know, having a multi-year plan about where these pivots are going to go and what we're going to do. And I say pivots, we still have the hard hose units. There's a reason guys don't use hard hose units. I mean, it's water, but you put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into making that water go. But when it's dry out, you'll do it. But it is a lot of, it's labor intensive and perhaps not very efficient. But on some fields where the topography dictates it, it's probably the most efficient way to do it. And a pivot what really just wouldn't be the way to do it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I really like this concept you said of more value per acre, and the area that I live, and I think a lot of the area I cover, it's pretty hard to procure more land. Even if it's not very productive, there's just land is getting more expensive, and a lot of times I'll even call it like a land lock. Like, we just really don't have any fields around us that are going to come up because we're surrounded by other farms, and they own a lot of it. They don't rent too much of it. And so we're kind of in that position. And so we've kind of taken that approach, but I've never even called it that, more value per acre, right? We put trees out in our farm in some parts, and we've got cattle that will graze through now. And we have had a very similar approach to that. So I really liked when you said that. I'm trying to figure out how to get more value per acre instead of necessarily going and buying or renting more land. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? And maybe, I know you've talked about like the soil health components or the irrigation components, but you've also got some diversification of your your revenue streams that you've looked into. And so if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I think creating more value per acre is predominantly a business model for us, because it's we are limited on how much land we can get. It's a challenge here, as it is everywhere. And so you say, well, if you're not going to grow the farm in acres, you got to grow the farm in another way. And that's with the acres you have. And so creating more value means obviously increasing productivity with what we already do, but also looking at different diverse revenue streams. And so, you know, that's where anything that's different and new, I've always been interested in doing. I always laugh to certain folks that I'm always ready to try something new and different and lose money at it. So let's go for it. But you have to. I mean, you got to take a risk to learn things, right? And that's how you move forward. So, you know, over the years, that's what started, you know, probably 10 years ago coming out. Well, it's been longer than that coming out of college, sadly. But it was, you know, being just corn and soybean farmer didn't seem to work. And of course, you know, we did some other things too. But, you know, it's how to, on the majority of our acres, how do we do something different? Because if, you know, everyone's doing the same thing, and the guys that are doing it are also doing it at a bigger scale than we are, is that the model that we need to be doing? And so that's where you start looking at saying, well, it started out, quite frankly, trying to get contracts to grow seed for other companies or other specialty markets, maybe more food related markets. And quite frankly, having a hard time of getting a contract or getting into the door to work with other companies or do things. And so at some point I had a chip on my shoulder and said, well, we're going to figure out how to make this work ourselves. And that's how I got into doing certified seed production and growing that. And so that's, you know, growing certified seed for my own wholesale and retail use, and then doing custom seed production for some other companies has finally come using the facility that we have, and doing things like that. And then, you know, working with, you know, whether it's local distilleries or just trying to find other niche markets that can create more value per acre.
Related to the seed business, I think that something to point out in general is the value for a community to have somebody doing that, right? Because there aren't very many options to say, I've got some rye seed that I want to replant. I need it, get it cleaned. You know, it's just, there aren't a lot of people, businesses, farms out there that can clean it or do that custom work. So I would like to point out just the value, regardless of how much profit it adds for you. It's a community asset that you're doing that at the same time. So certainly something to keep track of and to note.
I appreciate that, Brooke. And I think one thing that I focus on more and more is just how do we collaborate within the community?
Okay, Carl, I gotta know, what is your favorite crop to grow, regardless of whether you can make money on it?
I love growing small grains. I mean, wheat is fun to grow. Really any of the small grains, or, you know, winter seeded small grains are fun to grow. So
you talked a lot about relationships there and how they're critical. Seems like it's a part of who you are. You just really value relationships, but it sounds like it's also been a success or a good thing for your business. any comments you want to make about like the relationships you have made and what you think's been.
Well, I mean, start off, I mean, MSU Extension. I mean, guys like you are just a wealth of information and knowledge. And I lean on MSU Extension and MSU researchers a lot for good hard data and, you know, bringing other farmers together to discuss these things. And, you know, I say that to suck up a little bit, but it's the truth. I'm a big,
I want to say I did not.
Part in the loneliness, I bleed green. And I think what MSU does and Extension Services do is just super important as an independent voice, as a voice of that's bringing forward scientific data, is just super important for the industry. So there's that. Having relationships with Brooke over the years has been super helpful, and other folks there, Extension. Other commodity groups, being a part of different boards, being on the wheat board, being part of the crop improvement board, has been good for me to, I think, offer my perspectives and hopefully give back to those organizations. And at the same time, been wildly beneficial for me to make those relationships that help me back on the farm directly and indirectly. I mean, they could be directly business type things that come about. And sometimes they're just more inspirational. They just inspire me to do things different at home. I think just being involved in the right kinds of groups and with the right type of people. And I guess those people are people that are always looking to learn. You know, I think that's my appetite and my desire is to always keep learning and be a student of life and a student of farming and have that mindset as a student. And I think that's what defines a lot of people I work with and the people that I have success with are their students too. They're looking to learn always and figure out new things. They're not settled down into what they're doing. And I think that's kind of a key approach for me. And that's who I try to, you know, make relationships with.
Very cool.
Yeah, I think back on some of our adventures together, Carl, and we've had some fun. Not all of them have worked out perfectly, but we've definitely had some fun pursuing new angles on malting barley and rye and other crops like that. So it's fun to have a partner like you to work on it in real life, you know, from a I just do it from a research station perspective and research and extension. So yeah. It's been a blessing to have you alongside and working out the kinks.
Cute. As you reflect on all of this, was there any parting words or phrase or suggestion you want to share with the other farmers that happen to listen to this podcast? Because it's not all my mom. I've looked. It tells me where people are located. And I know it's not just my mom listening. So anything you want to share?
No, I hope it's been somewhat beneficial. I think I'll be honest, pretty nervous to be on the podcast because I'm like, I'm not sure what I'm able to share and with others that's of value, right? And maybe that's just, I don't know, hopefully it's genuine humility, but I would simply say it's always worth trying new things, thinking outside of the box, being prepared to innovate, be prepared to collaborate, work with others. And it's just farming is just a fun thing to be a part of. It's so dynamic. There's always things to learn, always problems to solve. Sometimes that causes stress, but it's part of the job is solving those problems. But that's the thing, is don't be afraid to learn, always be a student. And
well, I want to thank you, Carl, for joining us and talking about how you increase value per acre on your farm. And I mean, there was a lot of great agronomic changes you've made, but I also hear that there's a lot of social or relationship curation you've done too. And so it's great to hear kind of how you've gone about this in a multi-pronged way. I really appreciate that. It's very thoughtful. And we all have learned something today. You did have something to share. So thank you for getting on. And thanks, Brooke, for joining me again.
Yeah. Yeah, this has been great.
Yeah. No, thank you, Monica. Thank you, Brooke.
This podcast has been brought to you by the MSU Extension Field Crops team. For more podcasts or information, please visit us at canr.msu.edu/field_crops. Thanks for listening.